Well, here, I'm very interested in hearing more about it myself, but I want us to finish in talking about the middle part of the brothers, and to talk about especially the conversations and exhortations of Father Zosima. We have been contrasting it with the Grand Inquisitor story, and we left with Dostoevsky's own claim that he written to a friend that he risked everything in placing the answer to Ivan in the life and teachings of Zosima. That he said, I proposed to make the sixth book, The Russian Monk, the answer to the whole negative side. I tremble for it. Will it be answer enough? He knew, working with a limitation, a setback, he can't make Zosima dramatic in the way that Ivan's poem is. And we sense that if the two are posed against each other, they contrast each other in numerous ways, and all of them, I think, are significant. And remember also that the way that the narrative transmission is given here, it allows Alyosha to tell the elder's story, so that in a sense, the preface is uncannily close to the way the gospel writers wrote. And this suggests a new aesthetic that I want to talk about more in a minute. The matter at hand is, however, very grave. The burden that Dostoevsky has to deal with is the question, does the Christian way work? Or is it rather a beautiful but impotent expression, a mere forerunner of secularism and the kind of control that the Grand Inquisitor brings? So Alyosha has put together this account from the sermon Zosima gave on his last day, but he has also gone back over a period of several months of his conversations with Father Zosima. And so some things were quotations of what he said in actuality, others said at various times and put together a compilation like that of the New Testament writers. The elder said, look after your brothers. And he has known, you recall, that Dmitri is in serious trouble. And when he bowed down to him at the beginning, in that mysterious gesture that they commented on, and said, what do you think he meant by that? Right? It was a sign that he knew already that Dmitri was facing terrible suffering, terrible trouble ahead. So his bow was to that suffering that Dmitri was to face. But has Alyosha not followed the elder's mandate to him to attend to his brothers in rushing back to attend to Zosima instead? So that's...
Where was that, look after your brothers?
Huh?
Where was the quote, look after your brothers?
Oh, gosh. It's in there.
It's in that chapter. Okay.
He definitely says it, and this is part of his comments and his conversation. But if you look at the beginning, before the chapter starts, before the whole account of Zosima starts, look, if you have the Norton, look on page 265. The author speaks of this method and explains that though it reads like a sequence, in actuality it was interrupted many times. That last paragraph on 265. And that Alyosha is writing it all down later, after the elder's death. And so there is that matter of memory of Alyosha, of the elder's, Zosima's reality. Now, if we stop and think for a minute, I'm going to emphasize a little bit different interpretive approach here from what you'll hear from Dr. Dupree. Epic often incorporates a form of transmission of this kind, right? It's we often see in epic that concern with the transformation from oral to written form, and that EPIC is concerned with the word of the people, and especially with getting the word to a people at a crucial moment in which they seem to have lost it or to be about to lose it definitively. EPIC therefore highlights the notion of memory and energizes the concept of memory in a very special way. I think all of the emphases that Dostoevsky gives to the form of transmission of Zosima's story are then a significant emphasis, and one in keeping with a generic reading of this novel as having epic elements, having perhaps predominant epic elements in it. And again, as I mentioned last time, there's a special concern connecting the style of the New Testament to the invention of the art of prose. And in a sense, I believe Hegel talks about prose as a great achievement of civilization, you know, a great advance over poetry. All right, so this is in a sense a reversal of, say, the way that Vico has talked about the superiority of poetry. Whereas Hegel talks about it in a rather abstract and conceptual way, the idea that connects it to the New Testament suggests what one author following on Bakhtin has called a prosaics, right, that there is an aesthetics that of the word that is about divulging, about communicating, about laying bare what is going on, about full disclosure, more or less, that has to do with the very poetics of the novel. It's of the novel as a form itself. You know, the novel is connected in that way to the New Testament narrative, and probably no other novel knows that as closely as the Brothers Karamazov does. Now contrast all of this, after we've been saying prosaics and so forth, with the poem of Ivan. And we might even go so far as to remember that Gogol's Dead Souls is called, as it says on the title page, poema. Right? It is a poema. Right? But Dostoevsky has moved away. If you look, almost a continuous graph from Pushkin to Gogol to Turgenev to Dostoevsky, getting less poetic as we go along, but toward a different aesthetic. Ivan remains in an old aesthetic, then, that is tied very closely to his to poetics of the poem, with its high-definition images, high-definition foreground, and its obscure background, its unimportant background, only as a mere backdrop of the Spanish Inquisition. Nothing really except a kind of atmosphere or mood for it to take place in. Right? The poeticized character of Ivan's language, given in Constance Garnett's translation, is it thou, thou, and so forth, the kind of pacing that is given in that in the diction of that section, is part of its problem, dare we say, as in the sense, not the sense that poetry is wrong, but in the sense that it is part of a romantic worldview, a romantic point of view that is unable to look at the reality of the world and accept it. I respectfully return the ticket, Ivan said. This is Ivan's interpretation of the Christian ideal. Now, yesterday, by the way, not yesterday, but 2 days ago, was the 20th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. And goodness, I couldn't read some of the comments. Yes, uh-huh.
I was just wondering if, like, concerning his poetics, you make anything of the fact that he never wrote it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think that's important too. We were just thinking about the significance of that in several ways, but I think that's important. Yes, in a sense, it's also oral, but it never really makes it to oral until he tells it to Alyosha. Mm-hmm. It's something he tells himself, mm-hmm. So it's almost an internal monologue, mm-hmm. isn't it? Until he actually gives it verbal form, tells his brother the story. No, the Berlin Wall anniversary, 20th anniversary, just made me think about the socialist program of Yvonne, and all of the. There was a nice piece by Roger Scruton, brief comment about it, and the conclusion that he reached was that the wall, not that the wall never fell quite, but that in a sense, in rejoicing over the fall of the Berlin Wall, he felt that he feared that he was on the losing side 20 years later. And many of the pieces recalled the moments, the weeks of the fall, and recalled the many people involved in regretting its fall, and wishing it hadn't happened, and trying to pretend it hadn't happened. So it is, we are indeed in a time that resonates, I think, very specially with Dostoevsky and with some of the vision that he's had. Certainly Russia itself, but I think our entire world. Again, I want to move on, but that's kind of a backward look at our Grand Inquisitor once again. We have to contrast in those two the meek Christ of Yvonne versus the active love of Zosima, the caritas of the New Testament, as Zosima espouses robustly, and all of the things that, all of the ways we could contrast Zosima's declarations with Yvonne's vision, and Zosima values persons as persons, that he discards sentimentality about them and about his world, that he dares, he's outward, outgoing, has a sense of merriment, that he has forgiveness, and that he has joy, qualities Yvonne is lacking in. Now, Alyosha, for his part, by the end of the novel, will be strong, and his timidity will be transformed into efficacy. But at this stage, he's as yet untried. He too is his kiss earlier is in part a sign of that immaturity, that he hasn't yet been able to come up with an equal response, a formulation, an approach for his to answer his brother. So that he is, in a sense, like Yvonne somewhat. That plagiarism, as Yvonne says, is not entirely untrue. But returning to the notion of epic here, we have overall a motif of the education of the hero in Alyosha, that he is yet to learn his own way. He has embraced it, he has espoused it, but he doesn't know it, and he doesn't live it fully yet. So one can't help but be reminded of a certain other epic hero, not a very Russian one, of Aeneas, right, who has embraced it, who has espoused it, but who doesn't yet know it, and who has many misadventures in the first half of the Aeneid before he meets with his own father and is told, right, the wisdom of the cosmos as best Virgil can formulate it. I find some interesting parallels there. I don't like as parallels that are too explicit or too close, but it indicates that part of the central structure of the brothers is a very epic theme. Yes,
I was wondering what you make out of the fact that phrase, that's plagiarism, isn't the first time it shows up in the book, but that Rakuten says it first to Alyosha. And then, I don't know, it's just that they both say it to Alyosha, they both say that's plagiarism in response to something Alyosha says or does.
Darn, I'd forgotten that. So. Good, well, what, can you remember what the...
It's in the chapter, A Young Man Bent on a Career, when we first get to meet Rakuten, and
yes.
Alyosha says, in describing Ivan, I think, he's describing Ivan, and he says he is haunted by a great unsolved doubt. He's one of those who don't want millions but an answer to their questions. And then Rakuten says, that's plagiarism, Alyosha, you're quoting your elders' phrases.
Yeah, very good. Well, that would fit exactly into what I'm talking about, that he's learning his lines. And so there's a sense in which somebody who's not, you know, who's looking for chinks in the armor is going to say, you know, you don't really have this by heart yet. And that is exactly what Rakuten is up to throughout the novel. We find him a particularly mean-spirited and ironic character. Yeah.
So would you say the whole, like the novel hinges on this sort of book six, like discourse?
I mean, I think that's certainly just the heart of the novel. We may have run out of things that we're calling the heart of the novel, but I think this is probably it.
There's two things in it that really, to me, seem to undermine kind of what he's saying.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to root for him, like you want him to pull it off, to pull book six off, and that way the whole novel can sort of stand together as a whole. One thing that really concerned me was the idea of his constant like exhortation to take guilt.
Yes.
Upon himself.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like almost an impossible request to me, because it's possible to take the suffering of someone on yourself, but to ask someone to take the actual guilt of someone on themselves seemed like a well nigh it's almost unjust.
And we occasionally stop and think just how un-American so much of this advice is, you know. And that's, I think, a very good example. There's some things that just go absolutely against the grain of what we are told in our schooling from pre-K all the way up. That's a good example.
Well, it just...
On the other hand, it's exactly original sin.
Yeah, and that was the other part of it. He doesn't seem to accept the idea of original sin.
Who doesn't?
Zosima. Like
But that's what it means, in effect. See, we're all guilty. There's a scene later when Lisa describes. She talks about a story. She said, "Is it true that this Jew nailed up a 4-year-old child and ate a dessert while he was dying?" And it's an obvious allusion to the crucifixion. So what Zosima is saying, in respect to that, we're all guilty, you see. And if that's true, then the fact that man, we're all guilty of sin. We can't escape it. And if somebody sins, we partake in that sin. Each is responsible for all, you see, because each has shared in the same imperfections.
Yes.
That would make sense to me, except it doesn't really jive with his idea of the innocence of children. He also asserts over and over again.
But children don't have choices. You don't participate. You don't participate in evil until you've reached an age at which you can make a real choice.
Wouldn't that, though, also be undermined by the actions of the children in the story? I mean, we see a group of children.
No.
Like,
those aren't
children.
Those are, you know, older kids. We're talking about real children.
Like
someone
under the age of 5 or something.
Yeah.
I was just thinking of, you know, Smerdyakov in like the garden with the cats and
he's
the
a
kids.
Special case.
And the rock throwing and
But they're older kids.
No, but another aspect.
It's what they used to call the age of reason, which is supposed to be around 5 or 6.
Another aspect of the guilt, taking the guilt on oneself, is the imitatio Christi. That we are to do insofar as we can by Christ. So I think it's sound.
It's pretty orthodox. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that would, the idea of the pilgrim would fit in with that as well. I mean, Christ is sinless and unable to participate in the sin that he takes on.
Mm-hmm.
The guilt of ours.
Yes. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. I think so. So.
It's very different from Michigan, you are not to blame.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
It is right to hear it as like a paradoxical saying.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's
exactly.
It should be something that and even the way in which he says it, like each should accuse himself, almost to the extent, should accuse himself of before everything and everyone, like not even just people, but the whole world should in some way accuse you of your...
Yeah.
It's not meant to make you comfortable by any means.
That's quite true. Oh, and he does it with such a joyful and positive delivery. But other than that, we're very much tempted to say non merci. You know, refuse delivery. Yes. Uh huh.
Isn't there still a problem though in the way that he just views sin, like the fact that he characterizes animals and the earth as sinless?
Do you ever see an animal commit a sin?
Well, okay, but that's kind of proves the point that I want to make here, that animals are not souls, you know, in the way that people are. And he seems to want to deny that creation is in need of redemption, which is not biblical either.
Creation's fine. It's good. It's human beings.
Right, but after the fall, like, creation is also messed up, and he seems to want to deny that.
No, creation is just messed up for us. It's okay by itself. You live with us, creation will be fine. Think
like
of the environment.
So this world doesn't need to pass away at all? Like, I mean, it's just, there's something problematic in this.
There is definitely not a Calvinist approach.
No.
And it's not... Not a Calvinist nor a Lutheran approach, by which when the fall happened, the fall was an utter fall, right? And that man is no longer sees God mediated in creation. This is not what the Orthodox believe. Right? The creation remains the creation.
I'm a cradle Catholic. This is the stuff I got from the age of one. There's nothing particularly Russian Orthodox about this.
Absolutely.
It's just Orthodox.
Yes. That's right. Here. So, you know, Protestants and Catholics still fight over shadings and emphases, right?
Yeah.
And of course, Catholics fight with Catholics over that as well.
But it's also part of what Bakhtin calls the polyphonic. Got these voices contending with one another.
Okay.
There's all right. No real sense. Yes.
I was wondering, I mean, it seems interesting to me that throughout what we've seen, at least in Crime and Punishment with Raskolnikov's Open Confession, the need that the mysterious stranger has to confess openly and not just have an inward conversion. It seems so, like, in with the idea of one for all and all for one, like carrying on that guilt of sin. And is that more Russian Orthodox? Because I feel like, at least, it seems like to be very like concentrated on opening to society, not just like to the believers as well, but really confessing to all, and that's the only way he can free himself.
I think the notion of the road of the people, subornos, the community, would intensify that, mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. Uh-huh. That's a good point. Yes, yeah, so down over in the corner. Did you have a question or comment? Okay. All right. Yes.
Well, if Tikhon's advice to Storogin, though, is not to make a public confession. He doesn't dissuade him from that, but he actually advises him more to do a kind of a private mentorship with another mm-hmm. elder.
Yes. Uh-huh. And actually to discipline him, to submit himself to religious orders of some sort.
Yeah. Because his problem is a little different, I guess.
And Tikhon is different.
That's true.
See, that's the other thing that's so interesting of Dostoevsky. No two are alike. Hmm. And that includes throughout the novels.
Right.
Every one of them is distinct.
Absolutely. And so, therefore, we see why, Dostoevsky places Zosima in a dialogical context, right? With his, after his death, everything is thrown up for grabs, and we have to decide, although it makes it fairly easy for us not to like Father Ferapont, so that should be easier, and yet there's a dialogical relation. Yeah. Father Ferapont has points to make, and so a stricter interpretation is one that would deny what Zosima is saying. Now, Angela, you had a turn already, so I'm going to wait for a bit. Jessica, go ahead.
Just a clarification of something you said earlier when you said, quoted Father Zosima saying, look after your brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Did you mean the place where he said, go to, make haste and find him, you may be able to prevent something terrible?
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
That's what you're talking
you
about?
You are right.
Okay.
Where is that?
It's on 285 in my edition. I have this
one. Yeah, chapter.
It's in the chapter of the Elder Zosima and his visitors.
Okay.
It's about
okay.
Into it.
All right, that's good transition too, Jessica, because again, where I left off, we were just talking about Alyosha being immature, of his being untried, was making the wrong choice. That he's with the hero worship of Zosima. Dostoevsky's great art here is to show that there, with every presenting of some utterance, there is a point of view toward that utterance. And so Alyosha, as much as he loves him, as much as we love Alyosha, you know, and trust his transmission of Zosima's legacy, here we have to see also at the same time that he is subject to a kind of hero worship. And so his hero worship is directly addressed by what happens after Zosima's death. That he had presumed, along with the town and so forth, that the holiness of Zosima would manifest itself in a set way, in a preordained way, with the preservation of his body. And so this is denied. But also, you know, in having to choose between what Zosima says and between honoring Zosima, he chooses to honor Zosima, go back to him. So he deserts not only Ivan, but Dmitri, and he takes no responsibility at all for Smerdyakov, of course. His desertion it could be looked at as an offense, right? Of disobeying his elder. And of also, you know, am I my brother's keeper? That he is not his brother's keeper. The murder of Fyodor occurs during the time that Alyosha should have been there with his brothers. So that's pretty serious. All that is not really stressed in the novel, but it is structurally there, and that Dostoevsky intends us to put that together. All right. So, but back to Zosima. Zosima has been influenced by his brother Markel, who in his last illness enunciates the great theme of the novel, each is responsible for all. And you recall that he asks the birds for forgiveness, saying that if he'd been better, well, the birds would have been happy. And you can recall Alyosha's memory of his mother. This is Zosima's memory. And again, the epic function of memory. There's a saving memory that can get you through some of the worst possible times. This is Zosima's memory, his brother. Alyosha's memory of his mother. Dostoevsky has resurrected that epic theme of memory, not as a convention of epic form, but he's found new life for the act of memory and for the epic function of it, to call people, to give them a sense of calling, because it's that is the way that this memory serves in Zosima. Nonetheless, Zosima, in his own life narrative, gets in lots of trouble, leads a dissipated life, leads up to the duel, and strikes. What he's most disturbed by is not the duel, but that he's struck his servant. He goes down on his knees before his servant, and then, of course, from there goes on to enter the monastery. After that, with chapter 3 from in the Norton, the 292 to 302, is his sermon that is really the heart of the novel. Again, it's less dramatic than the Grand Inquisitor tale, but is a unique work in literature. And if we pay attention to it, it's likely to lead us to many questions. Apparently it already has done that. And possibly to change our lives, just as if it had been a real character that had said these things. Dostoevsky himself, of course. All right, well, I'm going to cede the stage now to Dr. Dupree, and we'll take things up.
Okay. I get ready for some difficult stuff.
I want to mention something, though. You remember, as a kind of transition, you remember when Ivan does tell Alyosha about the Grand Inquisitor story. He says, I've been telling this to myself over and over again. And so we see that he probably elaborates this story. It hasn't remained fixed, but that it is a story that in some sense or another is a guiding story for him. Now, in literary criticism in the last decades, there has been a tendency to speak of a master narrative. The master narrative usually has a strong political ring about it, doesn't it? It means you're a Nazi, you're a whatever you are, you're a Christian, you're a, you know. And you've got this master narrative that determines the way you see the world. It's the story, the real story, the way things either ought to be or are going to be. And we've talked a little bit about Bakhtin's concept of the polyphonic, and he, or the dialogic, and he contrasts the polyphonic and the dialogic imagination with the monologic imagination. The monologic, then, is in a way a kind of fictional master narrative. All right? You follow me so far? I started thinking about this recently and noticing something I hadn't noticed before in Dostoevsky generally, and that is a tendency for his novels to move further and further away from what we might now call the classical realistic novel, which is dominated by a single figure, and as Dr. Cowan and I were discussing just before class, is typified in many ways, though not exclusively, in Crime and Punishment. It's very clear that Raskolnikov is the central figure. And in The Idiot, though there are perhaps slight shifts in that novel from what Dostoevsky is doing in Crime and Punishment, it's very clear that Mishkin is the central focus of the novel. Everything revolves around him. But what about the devils? Who's the hero of the devils? Huh?
Rekovinsky.
Yeah, but he's not there at the end, is he? And he sort of, we start out with him and we think he's going to be the hero, but then there's that funny ambivalence, that comic presentation of the narrator at the beginning. And we think that Verkhovensky sees the light. He realizes that he's been a foolish man and that he really, in the end, sees himself in perspective. But almost an ironic hero, isn't he? More than a real hero. He's done a lot of damage, not intending to, of course. In The Devils, we begin to see something interesting happening in Dostoevsky that doesn't quite happen in any other novelist that I can think of at this time. There will later be in the 20th century thing, novels with titles like A Man Without Character, or A Novel Without a Hero as a subtitle, and so on. But
Or Invisible Man.
The Invisible Man, and so on. Although that one does have a very definite single protagonist. And you notice that Dostoevsky starts The Brothers Karamazov with a kind of apologetic introduction. I know you're not going to like this hero of mine. In fact, you may not even think he's a hero. Not much of a hero, anyway. And it's true. Alyosha is sometimes overwhelmed by a whole ocean of events and a whole swarm of other characters that seemed to put him in the background rather than the foreground. Now that changes a little bit as we get towards the latter part of the novel, but still, he doesn't really dominate the novel in the way that most novelistic heroes do. What is going on? What I propose is going on is a parallel on the narrative level to the polyphonic and the dialogic.
My first question was what to call it, because apparently criticism hasn't come up with a name for this yet. Either that or I just haven't been keeping up, and I'll tell you, it's pretty hard to keep up, and a lot of it's pretty, I don't know. I want to be charitable towards my colleagues in the literary world, but a lot of it seems to me to be just off base, barking up the wrong tree. So I thought, Polly what? Well, all right, let's back up. Psychologists and literary critics have not only been talking about a master narrative, they talked about the way in which each of us imagines a narrative for our own lives. Each of us projects a story. And that story is determined by all kinds of forces external to us and all kinds of forces that are internal to us. Have you heard this before? Sure you have. Maybe. So each of you has a story. Right now your story probably has a not terribly remote ending. You're going to get a BA and get a job. You're going to get an MA and do something with it. And you're going to get a PhD and God help you. You'll be a teacher if you're lucky. And most of our PhDs aren't just lucky. They earn it and they get jobs. In fact, almost all of them do. The only ones who don't are the ones who don't want to do that anymore, or never did. But you're telling a story. What am I going to be when I grow up? And so on and so forth. On the other hand, there's another story running alongside this, isn't there? There's a story your parents have been telling about you. Is what your parents want to be what you want to be? Be honest.
In some aspects.
Yeah. In Chinese families, traditional Chinese families, give their children names that tell what they aspire for their children to be like. Right? So a girl might be Mei Ling, that is beautiful flower, that is lotus. She will grow up and be beautiful and marry, and, you know, all of these things. And a boy can be all sorts of things. And by the way, when you translate a Western name into Chinese, it has to have a favorable meaning in Chinese. It can't be arbitrary or bad. And I had a friend who's, let's see, what was his name now? Gosh, I can't remember his English name. Isn't that funny? But anyway, they translated into Chinese as Da Shan, which means tall mountain. And he was indeed. He was about 6'3" and, you know, pretty good frame. So that's the way it works. So now we're beyond the family here, though. You see, we're in a cultural narrative, right? Your society makes up a narrative about you. And you perceive people. People are perceived in this way. And then there are all kinds of other narratives. There are suppositions. There's gossip. There is, oh, he belongs to that type. There are biological narratives. He is biologically, or he is environmentally disposed in this way, and so on.
Profiling.
Racial profiling is a narrative. All right, now, I was trying to think, how does literary criticism handle this? And it suddenly dawned on me that literary criticism has been handling this for a very long time. This is UD, so I know the answer to this question. Have you ever heard of Dante and the fourfold method? And is there anybody who hasn't? Don't be shy. All right, but let's go back and look at what the fourfold method really means. Now, you remember that it's called, in the letter to Cangrande, it's called polysemous, that is, multiple meanings. But what if we said it's really multiple narratives? Because, in fact, if you look at the way Dante describes the Divine Comedy, and if you look at the fact that this technique of analysis was developed for the Bible, viewed as one long narrative from beginning to end, suddenly you realize that it is exactly what we're talking about here, sort of. Exactly, sort of.
Exactly in this sense, that every narrative is stacked with and enclosed by other narratives. But in this case, in the case of polysemousness, and you remember they were the what? What was the first level? I forget. Thank you. I'd forgotten that. Don't we forget that one too readily? The literal level. We like to dive off into some symbolic realm right away, and we forget to stay with the concrete and the what is really happening. All right, so there's the action that's described, the literal level. What's the next one? Or a next one, if you can't remember the next one.
Tropological.
Tropological, what is that?
Turn.
Yeah. Well, tropos, yeah, meaning turn, yeah. All right, and we're gonna sort of shift these a little bit here. I'm going to give them other meanings, but I think they're perfectly consonant. With, all right, so the tropological, and then?
Allegorical.
The allegorical. Uh-huh. Allos, other. Tropos, turn. All right, and what's the other one?
Allegorical.
Oh, isn't you degrading? I'd have to have a whole semester for this in some other places. All right, now. Oh, you did, didn't you? That's right. All right. So now let's think about that a minute. How could we render that? So what are these different levels? All right. So the narrative level of the Divine Comedy is literally. Well, you know the story.
A guy gets lost and he ends up in heaven.
Well, he ends up seeing heaven. He doesn't really participate in any active way. He's a passive viewer. He sees all of this. Okay. What is the tropological? What is that? What's the allegorical tell you? We're told.
It's allegorical, it's like the soul, right?
Yeah. It's the state of the soul after death, right? And so on. What's the tropological? What do you turn to? You know, the tropological, remember, is the moral. And we could say, to some extent, the communal also. It's the turn of the soul from evil, away from evil, towards good. And then finally, the anagogical, ana, up, go gain, to lead up. It answers the question, where are you going? Tropological, how did you change? The allegorical, what happened in your soul as opposed to, you know, physically? Where are you going? And that question is answered then in quid tendas, where are you going? Now let's call these by different names. Let's call these the literal level, who does what to whom? Who does what to whom? Let's call the moral or psychological. What's happening in your soul? Rightness, wrongness, from misery to happiness. Let's call the tropological, look at this, that would be the tropological. Maybe we should call the allegorical something other than just what's the history of the soul. Maybe we should say, what is the soul of the community? What is the belief system you belong to? What have you become as a result of being part of your city, your community, your culture, your race, your religion? So in the Christian world, of course, the narrative here has to do, the communal belief has to do with faith, it has to do with the fall, with redemption, and so on. All right? And finally, where are we going? So let's look at it in different ways and say, who am I? I am me and nobody else. Or I am my community. Or I am human nature. All right, these are all parallel identities, and with them, each of them has a parallel master narrative.
I was just going to clarify and make sure I got this right. So you're calling the tropological level the more psychological?
Yeah, the moral psychological.
Okay. And then
where we're faced with decisions.
Okay.
And where we are confronted with tensions within ourselves and so on, the psychological.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then just repeat one more time what you just went through, that I am me, I am my community.
Oh,
just
this
repeat
is
it one more time.
Okay. I am me and no one else. I am my community. I am human nature. And for just a moment, think about the brothers in this life. All right?
Mm-hmm. Are you suggesting a me considered in body and me considered in mind?
No. No, just me. My brown hair, my blue eyes, and my innocent soul. No, just me, my identity as myself, differentiated from everybody else. And of course, that's impossible. But now we're going to see that this gets far more complicated, because we're going to move from the polysemousness of this model to what I just thought up a term for. Forgive me. It is not an easy term. Although a variant of it has been used by those fearless post-structuralists and so on, and structuralists. All right, in Greek, there is this word, die, oh, that's an eta, die, die gem, let's see, we need a move here. There we go. Diegema. Diegema. And, you know, in narrative theory, they talk of the diegetic and all of this is derived from this word. But it turns out this is a perfectly good word in English that we can appropriate a portion of, and that is paradigmatic. So I'm going to call it polydigmatic. The polydigmatic. You heard it here first. This is its debut into the world of literary criticism. It may die a very young death indeed, but that's all right, you know. Now, what is the polydigmatic? The polydigmatic is the recognition that there is no one story that exhausts an individual, or for that matter, a community, or anything human. That just as in polyphony, we have many voices, and we have to take them all together, according to Bakhtin at least, in order to arrive at a whole meaning. So, and you can see already how this might tie into each is responsible for all, that we are all guilty, we are all implicated in humanity, and so on. But I'm interested in how it's carried out technically in Dostoevsky. And I want to start with a character who is not right at the, she's an important character, but she's not one of the utterly key characters, and that's Grushenka. And look how Dostoevsky handles this. Really interesting. Darn, how did I lose my place? It's in both together, which is chapter, what chapter is that? Chapter 10 in part 1. I never can get straight how that works in these books. All right, page 135 in the Norton edition, in any case. So Alyosha is visiting Katerina Ivanovna, and she is startled to discover, that somebody else is there. This starts on 133. I've come, murmured Alyosha confusedly. He sent me. Ah, he sent you. I foresaw that. Now I know everything, everything. I foresaw that. Right? Just in that word, foresaw, we see that Katerina Ivanovna has a narrative going. Right? In fact, she doesn't just have a narrative going. It looks as though she is stage managing it at the same time. Because who's there without Alyosha's yet knowing it? Grushenka. And what is the narrative about Grushenka at this point for Alyosha? What's the epithet that's given her? The creature. Or the beast, depending on your translation. So, Alyosha is, this is on 135 now, and all of this is about whom Dmitri is going to marry. Of course, a betrothal, right, is a narrative. A betrothal is a mark of a narrative. You've predicted what's going to happen with two people, socially, communally, and personally. Let me forget me as his betrothed. And here he fears that he has dishonored my eyes. Why? And so on. And so Alyosha goes on to tell what happened with Dmitri and his father and so on and so forth. And then he says, then he went to that woman, right? And do you suppose that I can't put up with that woman? Does he think I can't? But he won't marry her. She suddenly laughed nervously. Could such a passion last forever in a Karamazov? It's passion, not love. All right, so this is her narrative for Dmitri. It's passion, not love. He won't marry her because she won't marry him. Again, Katerina Ivanovna laughs strangely. He may marry her, said Alyosha mournfully, looking down. He won't marry you, I tell you. That girl is an angel. Do you know that? Do you know that? We think, huh? Wait a minute. Are we talking about the same person? She is one of the most fantastic of fantastic creatures. I know how bewitching she is, but I know too that she is kind, firm, and noble. Why do you look at me like that, Alexei Fyodorovich? Perhaps you are wondering at my words. Perhaps you don't believe me. Agrafena Alexandrovna, my angel, she cried suddenly to someone peeping into the next room. Come into us. This is a friend. This is Alyosha. He knows all about our affairs. Show yourself to him. I've only been waiting behind the curtain for you to call me, said a soft, one might even say sugary, feminine voice. And so she comes out, the beast, as his brother had called her half an hour before. And yet, one would have thought the creature standing before him most simple and ordinary. A good-natured, kind woman, handsome, certainly, but so like other handsome, ordinary women. It is true, she was very, very good-looking. Ordinary's in quotes. With that Russian beauty, so passionately loved by many men. She was a rather tall woman, though a little shorter than Katerina Ivanovna. Was exceptionally tall. She had a full, notice already, exceptionally tall, and that already kind of jibes with what we see of Katerina Ivanovna. She had a full figure with soft, as it were, noiseless movements, softened to a peculiar oversweetness, like her voice. And you think to yourself, like a cat, huh? I mean, what moves without, you think of a cat, and think, what's going on here? There's something kind of funny here. Noiseless movements, soft voice. She moved not like Katerina Ivanovna, with a vigorous, bold step, but noiselessly, Her feet made absolutely no sound on the floor. She sank softly into a low chair, softly rustling her sumptuous black silk dress, the little black dress, and delicately nestling her milk-white neck and broad shoulders in a costly black cashmere shawl. She was 22 years old, and her face looked exactly that age. She was very white in the face, with a pale pink tint on her cheeks. The modeling of her face might be said to be too broad, and the lower jaw was set a trifle forward. What does that mean? Her upper lip was thin, but the slightly prominent lower lip was at least twice as full and looked swollen somehow. Like a pout? Are you beginning to wonder what's going on here? But her magnificent, abundant, dark brown hair, her sable-colored eyebrows and charming gray-blue eyes with their long lashes would have made the most indifferent person meeting her casually in a crowd in the street stop at the sight of her face and remember it long after. She's an ordinary, very beautiful 22-year-old woman who looks exactly her age. Now, this is Alyosha's view, I think. This is what Alyosha sees. And it's in stark contrast to the beast or the creature. What struck Alyosha most in that face was its expression of childlike good nature. There was a childlike look in her eyes, a look of childish delight. She came up to the table, beaming with delight and seeming to expect something with childish, impatient, and confiding curiosity. The light in her eyes gladdened the soul. Alyosha felt that. There was something else in her which he could not understand or would not have been able to define, and which yet, perhaps unconsciously, affected him. It was that softness, that delicacy of your bodily movements, that cat-like noiselessness. Now it becomes explicit. There's something not quite right? It's hard to say. Yet it was a vigorous, ample body. There's a paradox going here. Her figure suggested the lines of the Venus de Milo, though already in somewhat exaggerated proportions. I'm trying to imagine that because the Venus de Milo is in exaggerated proportions if you think about it. Well, connoisseurs of Russian beauty could have foretold with certainty that this fresh, still youthful beauty would lose its harmony by the age of 30, would spread, that the face would become puffy, and that wrinkles very soon appear upon her forehead and round the eyes. The complexion would grow coarse and red, perhaps. In fact, it was the beauty of the moment, the fleeting beauty, which is so often met with in Russian women. Alyosha, of course, did not think of this. All right. Now, what happens? What happens next in this chapter?
She plays Katerina for a fool?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
She breaks out of the narrative.
Yes. This is Katerina Ivanovna's narrative. She is playing a part in it. She is playing a role. How do we know she's playing a role? When does Alyosha see her next?
After his elders died.
In the chapter The Onion, right? And there, what's the first thing he notices?
She's lost that sugary sweetness.
Yes, the voice has changed. And she doesn't move like a cat any longer.
No, except when she jumps in his lap. It says specifically that she jumped in his lap like,
yeah. Well, no, that's exactly it. See, that cat-like, you're right, that cat-like business is the little hint in here that she's acting out something, that this is not really Grushenka. And so we see Grushenka and we see Alyosha. Alyosha is playing out what he thinks is the role that his model, Father Zosima, represents. He thinks this is what Father Zosima wants him to be. Father Zosima has a totally different narrative in mind for him. He's not going to be a monk. In fact, if each is responsible for all, he'd better get out there and take care of his two brothers and anybody else that needs it. This is active love.
We passed over that laugh line early in the novel where he says, "You will even have to take a wife. Yes, you will have to suffer everything."
That's right. It's bad news, Alyosha. You can't shut yourself off from the world and be pious. You're going to have to go out and earn it. And this has not been Alyosha's narrative. And this narrative is, of course, shattered utterly by another narrative. What is the narrative about Zosima? His body is not going to be corrupted, right? That's the saintly narrative. And Zosima fools them by decaying.
Uh-huh. Are we also supposed to see it like a narrative of the suffering and humiliation of Christ and then his disciples turning away from him and then the resurrection? And then
could be. You see, here's the thing. In the Christian world, Christ represents the only narrative that we're supposed to heed. We're supposed to try to be like Christ. But you can be like Christ in many different ways. And you can be unlike Christ. And you'll notice that Ivan's all right with God. He doesn't like God's narrative. That's what he doesn't like. Doesn't like God's story. And he doesn't want to be a part of it. And so you could say that Ivan is saying, "I don't like this performance. I respectfully return the ticket. I'm not going to this show. I don't approve of it. It's a nasty place, your theater, God." Well, all right, I'm going to pursue this a little bit more next time.